This is Comics Therapy, episode 25. No reviews, just analysis. And in fact, this week, not even much of that. Aaron and I are at Image Expo, so we've made arrangements for some alternative hosts for your education and entertainment. You can check them out right after this segment. But first, in all seriousness, we're going to talk with one of the hottest young writers of 2013. We're very excited to welcome Frank Barbary to the couch. Frank is the writer of Five Ghosts, published by Image Comics, which we talked about back in episode 15, and two upcoming miniseries, White Suits and Blackout, both published by Dark Horse Comics. Thanks for joining us, Frank, and Happy New Year! It looks like 2014 has a lot in store for you.
Thank you so much for having me, guys, and Happy New Year. I had to choke back laughter at the intro of Hot New Writer.
You can take that however you want.
Yeah, we're going to make sure we put up on the blog, like, your headshots and some of the modeling videos you've done.
Oh, you know, they're out there for everyone to enjoy, so, you know.
Is there anything else in the works you can give us a heads up about besides what Andrea mentioned? Or
There's like, a few more things. The big thing is I'm doing the Solar Man of the Atom reboot for Dynamite in April, part of the Gold Key launch. Which I'm really excited about because that's been an awesome experience where basically I was handed this character and they said, do whatever you want. And the other people writing, and this is not some silly humble brag, but I'm part of a really crazy lineup. The lineup being Greg Pak doing Turok Dinosaur Hunter, Fred Van Lente doing Magnus Robot Fighter, and then Mark Waid doing the Occult Files of Dr. Spectre. So
yeah, it's crazy. Like, those Gold Key characters have so much potential, too. I'm super excited about those.
And thankfully, because I'm involved, I've been able to see everything, and it's so good. And I think a lot of people are going to be, like, caught off guard by how good it is. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think I've pre-ordered all of those as they've come into previews, because I have a lot of love for the characters, and you know, it doesn't necessarily hold up over time, but the potential of the characters themselves with, like, new, fresh talent kind of behind them is really exciting.
The best part of it.
Young, hot talent, right.
Emphasis on hot. That was an underline bolding.
Right.
But no, it's really cool because everyone's approach is, like, a reinvention, not necessarily in, like, a silly, like, aesthetic way, but, like, definitely the way it needed to be handled. And our editor is Nate Cosby, who was brought in, like, as, like, kind of like a freelance editor. And Nate used to work at Marvel and, like, brought, like, his big thing was Thor the Mighty Avenger. He was kind of in charge of and brought a lot of the talent involved in that into the industry.
Yeah.
And then he wrote Pigs over at Image and Cowboy for Arkea. He's doing some new projects, but he's in charge of it all. And I feel like he has such a good handle on, like, and again, myself removed from this, but, like, talent and who was a good fit for these books. So, and he's awesome.
You forgot he also did Buddy Cops.
Buddy Cops this year, yeah, with Doc Shaner, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the little gems of last year. Can you remind us, too, when White Suits and Blackout hit stands?
White Suits number one will be February 19th. So really looking forward to that, as that's been in development forever. It was actually, like, the first professional comics work I did back in, forever. Dramatically, but in, like, April 2011 or 2012, was when the first little short came out. But that'll be February 19th, and then Blackout is in March. I can't remember the exact date, so it's going to be a very Frank Barbary centric month. And I'm also doing a RoboCop one shot for Boom that'll be out in February as well. They did four one shots with some of my friends too, which is awesome. Three writers I really like. Excuse me. It was Joe Harris is doing one, Ed Brisson's doing one, and Mike Morisi is doing one. And then it was really cool. They kind of, like, we just picked, like, moments or aspects from the film to explore a little further in depth in, like, these one shots. And I actually just saw mine finished today, and it came out really, really awesome. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, that's cool. They've been doing some cool stuff with the RoboCop franchise, you know, recently too. So
and they're just the nicest people. Like, everyone I've worked with in comics is, which is so awesome. Like, when you finally start, like, dealing with others, because I've so used to just, again, handling it all myself, and it's so nice, like, when people are, like, excited and fun and, like, genuinely good humans, like, right. On top of, like, being good at their creative job. So it's been really, really great, and I feel really fortunate for that. So I'm not going to just sit here and self-congratulate myself, by the way.
We always allow time for that. So it's fun.
Every hot young writer needs a makeup artist and a stylist and a wardrobe person. It's not, you know, it doesn't just happen in a vacuum.
I'm just trying to think. There was one last. So it's RoboCop, White Suits, Blackout, Five Ghosts, still coming strong, and Solar. That's the beginning of my 2014. That's very stacked, but I'm really psyched on that. I'm trying to go, is there anything else I was doing? No. I'm developing a bunch of stuff on my own that doesn't like necessarily have homes yet, so I feel so just like buried.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm like, wait, when is what? But no, that's the stuff coming out soon, which is crazy because, you know, with previews, everything's been solicited almost at this point.
Right.
But it's nice to finally be able to talk about some of it, though, because Solar, especially, we've been working on since, like, the summer, and I think it's about to be solicited next month. The Magnus stuff was just solicited, which looks so good. The artist, Corey Smith, on that is someone I knew through Chris, who does Five Ghosts, because I think Corey also went to the Kubert School, and his work on that is ridiculous. Like, they sent it to me, and I was like, wow, like, I knew it was going to look good, but not this good, and he's, I don't know, I feel like he has a long career ahead of it, and just, like, killed that in a way that...
Didabin's been bringing in some talent that is really, they have a very set style, and I think they've kind of broken away, at least this is my opinion, but kind of broken out of that mold a little bit and finding some really kind of, you know, young, fresh people to the industry that just are really amazing and doing some really cool stuff. So it's going to be, I don't know, 2014 is going to be an exciting year for Dynamite stuff too.
Yeah. It was crazy because I saw, like, I guess it was right around New York or San Diego the week before they had all those announcements, and I was just kind of astounded by, so it seems like every, like, good creator is doing something there, which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I really liked that, and I remember when it was coming out, the Andy Diggle book, what was it called? Sorry, mother. The Andy Diggle book, oh my God. The one about the guy who could... The Uncanny.
Oh, yeah, right.
Awesome, awesome book he was doing there. I think it's still coming out.
It's still going, yeah. It hasn't ended. Okay. Yeah, I've been picking that up, too.
Awesome, yeah, no, that's a cool book. I read way too many comics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about White Suits and Blackout specifically, because they were both actually out first in Dark Horse Presents, right?
Yes, White Suits, a long time... Again, let me emphasize long. No, I guess it was April 2012.
Okay. That, I mean, it doesn't honestly matter because I don't read. I'm sorry. I don't read.
No, Dark Horse Presents. It was in Dark Horse Presents number 11. And it's just kind of interesting because the way that came about was that was a pitch I had started working on, like, right when I was still kind of before breaking into comics, when I was just kind of putting stuff together on my own and really trying to, like, explore and think, like, what can we do that is interesting and, like, will make publishers give a damn, pretty much?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so hard. It's that wall of just, like, breaking into any field. Like, oh, well, there's no way to really stand out. Like, they've seen everything. They get stuff day in, day out. Like, especially everyone who takes submissions. So it really just grew out of the idea I wanted something that would look, like, visually interesting. And then also, on top of that, be... like, follow through on that as well. And it's so awesome for me that Toby ended up being the artist on it, because essentially the other artist who had, like, worked on it, who I'd commissioned for the pitch, quit, like, after doing the first Dark Horse short, which was really not fun for me. But then my friend Giovanni Valletta actually did the second short, and then again, he was busy with his own stuff. So then I was like, shit, who can I ask? And my editor was like, well, try reaching out to people you like. And I sent Toby an email because I had seen, funny enough, I had sat next to him at a convention, like, years ago when he debuted the self-published version of Rod Racer. And I was just so, so blown away by it. And he was always on my, like, dream list. And I just emailed him and he's like, yeah, I have time. I'll do this. And again, still floored by the ease of getting someone involved in that. And he's one of my favorite artists working. And the fact that, again, I get to do stuff with him is insane. And he killed it on issue one, but I feel like once he knew, like, okay, just be you and do everything you want to do, like, he just is now going crazy in an awesome way. And this is, like...
So I'm actually curious about how you as a writer like plan going from a short piece in an anthology to then go to a miniseries or an ongoing. Like, how do you plan for that from a story point of view, having started in a shorter version of the story that you're telling now?
It's funny because this works out so perfect. This worked out so perfectly because essentially we pitched Dark Horse on a series, and I pitched them on the miniseries, which is what we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. And basically, it was a little bit of a different climate back in like 2011 when I pitched them. And this was a blind pitch I sent in. It was just like, well, maybe someone will look at this. And and it was a really like shitty time for me, like trying to get into comics because it felt impossible. So, I mean, that's why I always tell my friends, like, no, people look at their mail, like, just send it in, and you can never predict what they're gonna like. But that's why I was so crazy with the fact it needed to look really cool and get attention. Because right. Even the original pitch art like had some of the same style, like it was black and white with spot coloring, and mm-hmm. and had some of the similar pages that I wrote, but. But so we had the series outlined and like the whole mythology of it, and our editor at Dark Horse, when he liked it, he's like, yeah, we're not really greenlighting like create our own stuff right now, but we just restarted Dark Horse Presents and we're looking to launch new stuff in there. How would you feel about doing like, and he had basically the story Bible for it, which was way too long and convoluted, but mm-hmm. but he saw that there was like a big history to the project, and he said, oh, well, how would you feel about doing short stories like in that universe in Dark Horse Presents? And again, we'll see how it goes and gauge your reaction and then possibly build from there. To which, of course, I was like, of course, like I'll do right. anything. I'll do anything. Oh, please. Like,
but since you had already kind of planned it out in a different way, that meant that you were pulling out things that were appropriate to be featured in those smaller chunks.
Absolutely. And it really was really inspiring for me because it allowed me to explore three kind of character prequels, which we will have back in the trade. And I posted one on Tumblr, the one Toby did, which was the last one. But because we have a narrative that jumps back into the 80s and really kind of has a big scope to it, it was really cool to put stuff in those two shorts. And hilariously at the time, never knowing if we'd be able to revisit the payoffs. But all the characters in those shorts, even though they seem like kind of tangential, are re-explored and work into the mythology of the main series as well. So I'm really looking forward to when it's all together. People are like, oh, that's who that guy was, or that's how this mm-hmm. person's related. So mm-hmm. it really allowed me to like basically expand the mythology in my own head and get a much clearer sense of the story I want to tell. So it's really been in development for almost 2 years, and seeing now the payoffs of it, it just grew as one happy accident after another. So I'm really happy for that.
Well, it's funny. It's in a way, it's actually perfect. That was probably perfect timing to get involved with Dark Horse because they might not have known it at the time, but with Marvel and Disney and Lucasfilms and everything else, like the loss of Star Wars, I think has really lit a fire under Dark Horse to get to start developing a lot more creator-owned properties because they need to fill that gap. And it seems like it's like now's the best time to kind of get in with them because they're probably looking for stuff like that.
Yeah, and I'm so glad to see that. And I feel like clearly the big success story of the last like 2 years with creator owned this Image, but see that all the other companies who've always approached it like kind of like with like one toe in the water now are like, okay, well, shit, like yeah. we can do this too. And not in a like I don't mean that in like a pejorative sense, but literally like 2 years ago when I was trying to pitch comics to people, they were like, we will never make money on a creator-owned series. We don't care what it is. Thank you, but we need to see how the air clears first. And that was so heartbreaking. And literally when you're trying to like break in and to have someone say to you like try us again in 2 years, that just feels right. like right. forever. And it's crazy that now I'm seeing a lot of the initiatives a lot of companies are putting in place are stuff they were telling me about 2 years. And I mean, yeah. they were following through on it. And I'm glad to see like the market supporting that because the big joke we always say is, and clearly I always have to preface it with in no way do I think our book was anywhere near as good as East of West, but we tried to pitch Chris and I who do Five Ghosts, tried to pitch a sci-fi Western. I actually put it online the other day because I don't care. Look at it.
Last week you did.
Yeah, and it's funny because so many of the elements, and as I said, I mean, clearly not comparing it to East of West on a content, but stuff that they're doing there so successfully and people love, like publishers said to our face, like, you can never do this in comics because no one will buy it.
Do you think sometime, but it's got to be a mix of both content and creator name. Like Hickman,
But at the same time, though, too, it was like these were like pretty candid conversations because I was always upfront. I'm like, yo, like you don't need to give me your like fake rejection. If you just think it's bad, tell me. But to hear the genuine fear people had of both of those genres and then to turn around and look at books like, again, all from bigger creators, but still like the renaissance of sci-fi Image, where like there was a huge readership. And then Westerns too. I mean, in the last year alone, it was Pretty Deadly, East of West. What was the other one? My buddies do a book called Skybreaker.
Yeah, I got Black Science just started shipping too.
Oh yeah. And again, I feel like it's really a good time for genre fiction and genres that like publishers haven't been able to commercially exploit and like literally just wrote off as being dead. And even crime, I feel like, fell into that. Like there was a resurgence, but still like it's so funny being in a world of pitching comics and like it's just been like the vortex I've been stuck in the last like few years and so happy to be out of that and actually just moving forward. But it's always like talking with a lot of my friends or people who want to be in comics or now are in comics and being like, oh, no more crime pitches. Crime is dead. So-and-so told me they're not doing crime anymore. No more crime. It's like, oh, fuck, I was working on this thing. And real quick aside, which I think is the most interesting thing in comics and which is why I talk about it so much. So please, never. I don't approach that with any trepidation or anything like that. So let's talk about it.
Oh, sure.
I'm sorry.
Five Ghosts went from a successful Kickstarter to a miniseries at Image. And, you know, now it's increasingly popular ongoing series. You know, it made that leap. So I kind of have a question about that. You know, if you're getting rejected by publishers, you know, at least in terms of talking to other, you know, creators out there, like that market from the Kickstarter to published, you know, ongoing work with a publisher, is that, how do you see that as a viable, or do you see that as a viable way of kind of like breaking into the industry or making your story told if somebody else has said no?
I think this is where I've really arrived, especially after everything that's happened to me. But first of all, I think literally the day Image said we are going to do Five Ghosts was the luckiest day of my life and very much responsible for why I have a comics quote unquote career, like thankfully. And literally it was the exception to the rule. Like the fact that we kickstarted it and then ended up there is just the most bizarre, fortunate thing in the world. Like and that's not me celebrating myself. I'm literally saying it was like a shot in the dark, like weird moment of this work, because we had actually sent that in like when it was in pitch form almost like 6 months prior and it never heard anything. I thought it was rejected. It was just a point where I was so fed up with trying to get work published and I had the White Suit stuff brewing at Dark Horse. I said, and I just left teaching, so I now had no money. So I'm like, Chris, like Kickstarter kind of has some leverage. Let's at least Kickstarter the first issue. We'll self-publish it if we find any kind of audience. Because, and here's me like in the throes of desperation, like never having been able to sell anything to anyone. Like, frankly, I was like very much considering like quitting at this point. Like, okay, maybe not just good at this, like whatever. And so we did the Kickstarter, which was awesome. And it was nice to get that little bit of press. But even the Kickstarter wasn't huge. We had around 150 backers. And we only raised enough really to produce one issue, which is what the intent was, to finish out the whole issue because I could no longer pay out of my pocket to have all the art and coloring done. So we wrapped that up for New York Comic Con and self-published it. And we sold 60 copies at New York Comic Con. But we sold it out in a day and a half. And for the past 2 years, I had not been able to sell anything at my table. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, all right, I think people might actually like this a little bit. Like, and it was the first thing where people were actually talking to us about it and like interested in the concept. So we had a feeling that like, oh, well, this is still going to be an uphill battle, but it at least seems to like resonate with people. And again, Chris brings such like a beautiful, cool style to it. It was, everything just kind of fell into place. And from that, someone picked it up and gave it to Eric at Image. And literally 2 months later, I get an email that was like, I think it said, how much of this is done?
That's it.
And no foreplay there, just right in. And I'm like, and I wrote back like, oh, hey, like, thanks. Like, we have issue one done and it takes around an issue to turn around. And then like a month and a half went by and I was like, okay, well, what the hell? And then I just randomly, I think I was I think I was complaining about comics on the phone with my friend when I got the email, and it was like, oh, well, if you want to do this, we have room in March, so let me know. And I was like, oh. And like brain stopped and had a mini aneurysm and called the two people in the world who care about comic books who I know. And and then just went from there. And the whole thing, because a lot of people like to ask, like, oh, well, when did you decide to like push it to an ongoing? And with Five Ghosts, we wanted to do like, it's the one thing that I've done where I feel like I could write it forever. Like it has like such a universe behind it. And again, as you write more, you just discover like, oh, well, this is something like very organically we can keep doing. Cause I'm a huge advocate of not forcing more out. Like there's nothing you should just try to extend, especially in comics, which has such a small market and small world. Like, it's so obvious when you're milking something.
And
we never want to be that way. So initially when we were self-publishing and I was ready to pull my hair out, thinking about how I was going to finance more issues of this comic, we said, all right, well, let's try to do like a Hellboy model where we'll do a mini series every like maybe few years if we can make money and like build towards this, towards where we want to get to in the story. And I started mapping out like arcs I would do and things like that. So when Image came in, it was pretty much like unspoken from the get-go that no one ever said like, we're giving you a mini series or we're giving you an ongoing. It was really our choice to say like, okay, well, let's market this one of five because we want people to know that even if like this flops hard, we'll get through the five, we'll release that, and it'll be a like compact unit of story, and we'll go from there.
I think people, readers are getting used to that too. Like where they don't necessarily think that's going to be it after five. It's, we know that five tells the first part of the story, and if enough people like it, then hopefully we can do more.
It literally ends exactly how we would have ended the first like short series with that like character reveal, which would have just made people a lot more angry.
Yeah.
But also out of the gate, like I was so like walking on eggshells, like so concerned with Image and like looking stupid or like trying to look like too like just like annoying, like, well, we're doing an ongoing series, we've never published comics before, here we go, like we
here's our 100 issue pitch, and you better greenlight them all, and I'm up front, I want cash up front.
And I still know like how hard it is to try to like pitch anything and like new properties, and so we really didn't want to come out of the gate like seeming like bossy. But by the time we're at like three, I was like, oh, well, is it cool if we keep going? Because it seems like we have something going. They're like, yeah, whatever. We don't, like, do your book on time. That's fine. So I was like, well, that was really painless. And then we just went on. And
I kind of have a question. This is off script, but I'm kind of curious. Like, as the more you pitch to and more you make these industry contacts, does the sort of like the fear and the mystique kind of wash away, you know, in a way? Like, it seems like, and I'm totally outside of it, but you can at least figure out some stuff just from Twitter and press releases, whatever. I was like, you know, fairly small companies and a fairly small group of people publishing comics. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, does sort of like that sort of new, I don't know, new comic smell go away after a while? And it's like, it becomes more real. It's such a bad way of phrasing the question, but I hope it makes sense.
I think it's really just a matter of the magic being gone in the sense of, you know, exactly the fiscal reality of what you're trying to do everywhere because of exactly who pays what, how money breaks down, which frankly, like I knew going in, cause I was a crazy mutant who only cared about breaking into comics for the last 3 years. And, studied it from every angle in a horrible way, but it's more so just knowing, well, A, there's always the implicit fear that nothing is a shoo-in. Everything can be rejected immediately. Like you have no sense of, unless you are literally one of the like 10 people in the industry who is like so, so popular and untouchable, there's no sure thing. Like you still need to constantly, especially with your own properties, you have to show why this is cool. Like, that the art is good and that it's a saleable like idea in order to get any kind of leverage. I don't think that really ever goes away because just the market is what it is. And really just the fiscal reality of things, like understanding like, yeah, you can't pitch in 100 issue series because by issue six, like you're going to have this amount of sales and that turns into exactly this much money. and cool if you were rich and could bankroll this on your own and didn't have to eat. Like, yeah, go ahead and make comics forever. Uh-huh. But it's really just that reality. And I mean, the one thing that I feel extremely fortunate for is that I'm getting to do a lot of my own stuff, and a few people are taking crazy chances, but like, it comes with a trade-off. Like, we're not making money. Like, I mean, I'm making enough to eat, which is awesome, and thankfully I left my job, but it's still really rough. And the artists I work with aren't getting paid glamorously. They're taking just enough, which is an understanding we have that they care about the project and we're doing stuff we want to do, which I'm so happy to find collaborators like that, because so much of it is about the bottom line. And when it becomes work, you start worrying like, oh, well, here's where this breaks down and I have to pay so-and-so and whatever, which is why work for hire is such a huge relief as well. Like, as everyone knows, it's awesome to be paid upfront for something, but it just gets to a point where you need to approach everything with a purpose, and still, just at least where I'm at, tell the things you want to be working on, because there's no promise of it being great. We are so lucky that we got in at that time when Image was suddenly like even more cool than they've been in a long time, and like retailers were really supporting it and helping, and that's helped us so immensely. And we never would not mention that. Like, I'm so fortunate for that. But we very well knew our book could flop, people could not like it, and that would be that. But it wouldn't take away from, we did what we wanted to do. This was the book we did by ourselves. Issue one was exactly what we self-published. So just take away the small success of that, of knowing that this is a really hard industry and it's really hard to get in and get anything actually out. And the fact we managed to put something out was enough to really help. And thankfully, I mean, we're still doing that, but month to month is still tricky. Like, we're still dealing with the slide. Like, our sales have finally middled out considerably, which again, by no means is terrible, but to a point where this isn't negative, and any writer like will say the same thing, which is why I'm not like, shouldn't get like fucking points for like saying this, but it's like, yeah, I don't get paid from single issues of Five Ghosts. Like, that's not where I make money, and that's not doing anything, because the art team needs to be paid. And that's not a big secret. Look at dudes like Jim Zub, who will break down like the way things come out. Like, yeah, you need to be selling an immense amount of comics to like really be turning a huge profit, and that's the way it is. And anyone who comes into that, and that's the very first thing I learned when I started getting into comics, was when people are like, you need to pay artists to do a pitch, and it could turn into nothing. If you're not cool with putting your money up front and just shutting up about it, like, it's not really the field you should be in, because it's
Well, so what was that transition like for you? Because you're writing full-time now, and you were teaching, and then you were at Comixology, and like at a certain point, that had to have been a very deliberate decision to forego the stability of a more traditional job and like just take that fucking leap. Do you miss that stability? Do you
sort of when things go bad, like when it's like, oh whoops, like rent check's gonna be a week late. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And also, this isn't like bleeding heart bullshit. Like, I can just imagine a dude like Ed Brubaker wanting to punch me in the face whenever I pitch about my book like not selling enough. But it was for me, like, I was really wanted to be doing something. I didn't know if I had any place doing it, and I literally moved to New York with no job, like, and just on my savings, like, ready to go, and saying like, all right, I'll figure something out in the city. I don't want to be a teacher in the suburbs. I was living at home with my parents, which was awesome, and they're so supportive, but frankly, when you're 26 years old, debilitating in many ways. So I just moved out here and was like, well, I'll try to make a go of this and see what happens. And thankfully I found Comixology, which was such the perfect day job. And I loved it there, and everyone there is great. And it was so cool to be around comics all the time still when I was at work. But thankfully it just got to a point again where I'm like, well, if I'm really going to be putting everything I can into this and doing like the amount of like marketing I need to be doing, the amount of outreach, the amount of contact, and really build like a successful 14, I need to try to focus again. And really, unfortunately, I had to move suddenly in the middle of this and drain all my savings. So right now it's very much week to week, seeing what's what. But again, it's what I want to be doing, and I'm in a fortunate enough place where things just lined up. But I always know, and this is, thank God my parents always said it to me, like, because I used to be in bands, and I really loved music and, like, punk rock, and a lot of my friends, like, just were in touring bands, and, like, that's what they did. And even my twin brother, that was that was his life. He finished college miraculously, but then just like lived on tour. And I was always used to just putting up money and realizing there's no return. And like, you need to learn to make things work. And that's just what I brought to it, and understanding like, well, literally every dollar you make is a gift, and you have to think about it in that sense, not be bitter, because you're not the first person. It's not like you're the exception to the rule, which is why I always try to be so careful when I tweet and try to like up awareness of our book, because it gets to a point where I'm not going to call a retailer like in Connecticut that's a mom and pop store that probably isn't making a ton of money on their own, who only orders like 2 copies of our book. I'm not going to tell them to buy more of my comic, to buy a product they can't sell if they don't have people reading it, which that's crazy to me, to try to like push yourself on somebody. Like, that's why I really focus. I'm like, hey, if you like our book, please like pre-order it. That's how we get our month-to-month numbers and figure it out. And at a company like Image, which is awesome, it's all on you. Like, no one is paying you up front. Literally every sale is like money in our pocket, which goes towards making the book, which goes to, again, the book being made. And that's just how it is. And it's why you see stuff come and go, and why people are so adamant about promoting like that. But it gets to a point where, and that's why I say, you can't force people to like something. You can't force people to buy something. So we really just do the book we want to be doing, and we keep it really carefully metered and constantly talk like, well, hey, if this is where we got to, we'd really have to make a plan and figure it out, blah, blah, blah. But why I've been so candid about recently saying, like, when I talked to a few people, we have it plotted through 25, and getting to 25 is our goal before we take any kind of break or thing. I mean, it won't be a definitive end, but it'll definitely be like the end of a volume. And that's our plan right now. And everything looks awesome in place for that. So we're so, so happy and fortunate, because frankly, the fact we could get past the first 5 was astounding to us. And we're just so, so thankful for that. So, and that was my long-winded, probably gripey, whiny answer.
No, it was great.
No, it's good. I think that you're very good at self-promotion, and I mean that in a compliment, as a compliment. Like, it's...
Well, thank you, because every time I do it, it feels like prostitution.
but no, because you're very positive and approachable, but you're very honest about the challenge, and I appreciate that. And so I think that is a fair way of packaging all of the stuff that you're sharing, is that, like, you're very... very transparent about both the successes and the challenges.
And that's the whole thing. I feel like that's what I love about comics, is so many people are, because it's not any kind of crazy like rock star lifestyle. It's just that, oh, well, literally, like, there is a bookkeeping end to this that is all very systematic and accounting and business driven. And it's the hard like data. It's why if an artist says to me like, oh, could you give me $300 a page? Like, I will burst out laughing. Like, it's like, in a perfect world, yes, I would. I'd give you as much money as I could. But when you do a book on a company like Image, like, you literally get what you earn. Like, if people aren't reading your book, there's not going to be money coming in. So it's so hard to make people promises like that. And I think why a lot of people, especially breaking in, like, avoid creator-owned work. And anyone will tell you, anyone. And it's not like we're the exception to the rule, which is the first thing people need to get over when they start doing artistic endeavors, is just that you are going to bleed money. Which is why I've worked, and frankly, I should still be working, let's be real. But I'm fortunate enough to be in a position where I can just get by, and why I'm pushing to do new stuff and expand and make use of this time. But it's why, again, it's really hard to make it a full-time job. And especially as the writer, you're at the brunt of that. And not in a shitty way, but literally, you most of the time, drawing takes a considerable amount of time. People need to be compensated for their time, because they're going to choose between, well, okay, well, I can go to my job and feed my family, or I can stay home. And it's downright offensive to ask someone to try to do stuff for free in a position like that. And again, there's a lot of controversy about this online. And I just think one thing people need to consider is just the reality of some of the business. And it's something Chris and I discussed a lot moving in, and quite frankly, he drew issues 2, 3, and most of 4 or 5 goes without being paid. And he chose to do that with me and then split profit with me instead of just making me fork a page rate. And that was a really solid move. And we were just in a position where he was able to do that. And And again, he worked his butt off, and that's why we're so thankful to have an audience now. And it's a hard road, and you can't be. It's so easy to get bitter and get bitchy and be like, "Why doesn't my book sell?" Blah blah blah. I wish we were better, but like, we're still, for better or worse, in the phase of like, "Oh, thank God!" Like, someone bought our comic this month. Like, this is the book we want to be doing. And the same with all my projects. I'm so happy that everything I've been brought on board to, I'm excited about and is still fun. And again, with the work for hire stuff, so like Blackout, I'm really excited about, because I get to actually steer that ship with both Mike Richardson and my editor Chris, because it's a new character. I was a little worried that I was going to get handed a character like one of their like greatest comics characters, someone that I knew nothing about and would have to do all this research. But when they were like, "Oh no, it's a brand new character," like, it was really cool and liberating to like be a part of creating that and shaping that and like bringing my own sensibilities in rather than having to mine something really old. Conversely, then Solar came about, and again, it was the same fear of like, "Oh shit, like, is this going to be like weighed down by like history?" But Dynamite and my editor Nate literally just being like, "No, do what you do, like, tell the story you want to tell with this," which has been so liberating. And I think people are going to be really surprised and excited by a lot of the stuff we're doing in Solar. And the one thing I keep saying is, he's always been a very kind of like insular, lonely character. Like, because again, he's essentially like Dr. Manhattan and becomes like almost godlike. But so the way we really anchored that was, in my pitch, was to give him like a family, like a full cast of people who see this change, who see this character transform, and give them all different sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And it's really, at least for me, like balanced it out and made it a lot more personal, and still to have the like space stuff and the like crazy like universal aspect of the character, but also really just give it a nice like sounding board and make the character more of a character rather than just like a weird lonely god. And again, it's really bold for them to let us do that and change that mythology in like a fundamental way, instead of being like, "Well, no, this is who this character is, and we need to see this person, and this," and blah blah blah. But it gives you some
ownership. But it also, I mean, I think that there's a lot of trust there in your idea of what can bring new life to this character, right?
Yeah, and it's the most flattering thing ever. Because I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, really, they didn't have too much to go on when they reached out. But again, it's been really collaborative, which is awesome. As I said, I really love Nate, and Nate like will sit there and talk to me on the phone and talk through story stuff. And clearly, I like to talk, as we can tell. Not always about myself, I promise, but it's awesome. Same with Blackout. It's awesome to like sit there and talk with my editor on the phone about it and really just work through it. And that's what I love about writing comics instead of like prose, because like writing comics is so much of like breaking plot and really just discussing and forming, and not really sitting there being like totally in love with like your words or how pretty you wrote a sentence about describing a field. But more like, "Oh, like, what are the story mechanics here? Like, what are the characters doing? What's interesting?" And then you get to see someone else draw it, which makes that even more fun than just being like, "Well, I can read my prose back to myself and hate it." But so I think that's what a lot of people are excited by now, which is really cool for me, like, as a creator, because that's what excites me, like, and to see, like, new, cool, fresh stuff. And I think something that, like, Marvel has been doing so well, too, especially with their, like, new lineup coming out, like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
They're really letting artists and writers be themselves with mm-hmm. their characters, which is such a crazy risk, but I think paying off.
Well, so what are you reading for fun these days? Like, you said you read a lot of comics, and that's clear, but like, what should more people be reading besides your stuff?
I finally caught up on Mind Management, which is offensively good, like embarrassing as a writer to read and be like, "Holy shit, he does this every month."
Right.
And then the fact that Matt Kent writes and draws it.
Not only that, he does that and probably a dozen other books.
Yeah, and that's insane to me. He is really brilliant. And Red Handed was one of my favorite books of the year, I have to say. Like, he is such a talent, and that's so kind of like inspiring and crazy to see. What else did I just read? I was rereading Morrison Batman, which is one of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dude, you have to repost that list that you tweeted. Put it on your Tumblr so that it's all in order.
That's my friend William's reading order, and he's really, really smart and one of my best friends. And he is like a crazy academic and built this reading order. He's like, this is the way you have to read it for it to really like sink in. And it's an awesome reading order. I'll put it up. Yeah, yeah. I tweeted it, but it was like kind of broken up because of damn you restrictions of Twitter. But I'm trying to think of contemporary stuff up. I it sounds so dumb to say I read everything, but like Black Science, I love Remender's, all Remender's new stuff is phenomenal. I really liked his Marvel stuff. Uncanny X-Force was so, so good. And he sent me Black Science, Deadly Class, which is, again, offensively good. Like, in the art in it is so, so good. Like, the dude Wes he found is such a talent, and I'm sure you're going to have to be swatting emails away from people trying to hire him, because it literally looks like nothing else. I really like Hickman Avengers. I love John Hickman's work. Fantastic Four is so, 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 so good, his run. And I don't like the Fantastic Four, and that was... Like, I don't know, it blew me away. And solidified him as a creator. I mean, I love all his stuff. I really liked Red Wing, too, which a lot of people were just kind of like, meh about. But
no, I thought that was great. And that was Patara's, like, first, I think, published, really, like, published work.
Because I go to so many cons, I meet these people. It's not, like, being cool at all. It's just, like, everyone who goes to cons meet them. And it's funny that, like, Nick is such a personality, like, in the way he is such a good dude in a... He had art from Red Wing. He had that spread of the astronaut just kind of like rotting away. I'm like, I will buy that from you. And then he told me the price. I'm like, I cannot buy that from you, but I will.
No, it was a good investment. The first pages I invested in were two pages from Manhattan Projects number 3. It's the page where Einstein and drawing blank, but they're standing in front of the door for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Was it Feynman?
Yeah, yeah, Einstein? Right. And it's like that. I saw that page and I'm like, I have to have that. And that was like, you know, it was still pretty new. Like Nick wasn't as widely known as he is now. Like this has kind of been a breakout book for him, but he, you know, such an amazing talent. Awesome.
I'm such a dork for collecting art. The one like.
No way, dude. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I have so much art from Chris, which is funny. Like I have the first two pages or the first page of 5 goes in like the credits page, which he actually did on like colored like construction paper and like weird like charcoal pencils. And I was just like, must buy these immediately at low price. But but I have what sits over my desk now. It's actually the splash page from Joe the Barbarian where Joe is like looking at the horizon and the like second Earth is appearing.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Murphy sold that to me so on the cheap at C2E2 like 2 years ago when I had no money. So that's my one like original art. Like
beautiful. That's a great one.
Yeah, no, I'm so happy. I wish I had more. If I had more money, I would spend it all on art. And Remender was posting too that he like bought some of the stuff from Black Science. And I guess it was the cover that Mateo Scalera had done. It so pretty.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is kind of the point where we ask, do you have any like last words? You know, if this is your words of wisdom for the audience, this is how you'll change lives. So,
right. Dude, as a former teacher, this is like, you should be so good at this.
Well, the...
No fucking pressure.
No, but the big thing I feel like with comics is it's like highly attainable. Like, and I hate using myself as the model because yeah, there's luck and like, it needs to apply, but like, and it's why I tell my friends, like, yeah, shit can happen. You just have to do it. You have to like, not be afraid to, yeah, you're going to lose some money. You're going to feel like crap a lot and be rejected, but it's one of the few art forms and why I really got into it. And the same thing I liked about music and like punk growing up, like you can make your own product and it's not like you're entering into like a commercial vehicle. Like just do the stuff you love, like make things you care about. And the world is so small now and so connected that people will notice. And yeah, you can never control who's going to like what. And again, and that's why I always say, like, if someone could bottle, like, appeal and what was cool and what people liked, there would be a lot of really rich people out there and a lot of immediately successful people. But again, just comics is awesome because you can afford to do it. You can find someone to work with you. And yes, you're probably going to have to pay them, but... If you are above the age of like 15, get a job, save some money, like, and you can do it. It's something you can make and it's something you can share now because we have the infrastructure to do that. Like, I don't know how people did anything like in comics 20 years ago, like probably having to mail pages around and like, I do my own lettering. And that's my also positive thing as a teacher, be educated about it. Like, go take writing classes if you want to be a writer. Go take like art classes, meet people, like talk about it and there's no excuse for you to have to walk up to somebody and try to ask them like a entry-level question about like breaking into comics, because there's such a knowledge base on online, and there's people you can talk to. Like, email me, I don't give a shit, like I'll tell you when I know. But like Jim Zub has like posted such good articles that go so beyond just like this is how you put a pitch together, and more towards the like this is like honestly how you conduct yourself like in this environment. And
yeah,
and that's why I still love about comics, and what I always loved about music too is we all have the same tools, but to see the like different things people make is constantly inspiring and constantly cool. And yeah, it sucks that everything can't be a hit and everyone can't be like rolling in money and like at the top, but you shouldn't be focusing on that stuff, because that's not what it's about. We'll make our books like whether we can afford to or not to is basically what I want to say. I mean, we've been lucky that we have some publishers behind us, and I say we talk about all the artists I work with, but at the end of the day, just don't be an idiot and do your own stuff.
That's good. Don't be an idiot. I like that. That's a good
and never be afraid to have a backup plan, because at the end of the day, I know that if this all falls apart, I can at least go be a teacher again, and that's not such a bad gig.
So. Well, thanks again to Frank Barbary for joining us on the couch this week. Don't be an idiot, guys. Listen to Frank. And thanks to all of you for
Don't be an idiot. 2014 is our campaign.
Thanks to all of you for listening to Comics Therapy. In fact, we hope you continue to do so after this next segment. We'll be back with a regular show next week. But in the meantime, big thanks to Adam P. Nave, writer of Amelia Cole, Artful Daggers, and Neverending, and Twitter's own Cameron Williams for pinch hitting for us. We apologize in advance.
And don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local comic shop and subscribe to them digitally. It's important to ensure the lasting success of all the titles we all love. Show notes and other details are on the site, comicstherapy.com. Until next week.
Think that you're listening to Comics Therapy. However, this week we've hijacked the show, and we present to you the first and probably only episode of Comics Therapy. I'm Adam P. Nave. With me is Cameron Williams.
Hi, Adam.
And we are actually licensed therapists.
That's right. Licensing was provided from each other to each other for the purposes of this podcast. Outside of this podcast, not only are we not licensed therapists, we are not even licensed therapists. This is a one-off licensing.
It's true. This is about the quality you can expect from the two of us. Again, I think the standard disclaimer of we don't review comics on this show, we therapize them.
And in some cases, we may not have even read them for the show. So, I mean, it really is going to be a bit of a variation right there.
Are you already just revealing that I've done no prep work for this?
Well, I felt that it was good to get that out of the way, especially because, you know, people have come to expect a certain quality from the show. Not really listening to it, I don't know what that quality is, but I've heard there's expectations.
Yeah, no, those expectations will be ruined for the next hour. There's no quality going to happen here, folks.
Nope, we gave up quality control in the 10 minutes before the podcast, and we're just not planning to raise it whatsoever.
It's true. We didn't script anything. We didn't really plan much of anything. Andrea and Aaron were, I don't know, drunk, sick, dumb enough to give us the keys to the kingdom for a day.
I'm pretty sure he was drunk at the time, and she was sick. So that's my recollection of why they thought this would be a good idea.
It sounds like a really bad 80s cop drama. He's drunk, she's sick. Together, they fight crime.
You know, I'd actually watch that.
I'm pretty sure I have watched that. That's...
So which one of them gets to drive, though? The sick one or the drunk one?
The sick one. You know, drunk driving is nothing to laugh at there.
Back in the 80s, though, I mean, they laughed at everything.
Hmm. They did, didn't they?
Yeah, good times.
Good times. God, suddenly I'm remembering the special episode of Different Strokes, which was one of the most off-key, like, badly thought-out things you've ever seen.
That's saying a lot, too, isn't it?
Well, it involved, I don't know if you ever saw this thing.
There's a chance it might have been out of my viewing habits at that age.
You were, like, in a crib going, what the hell is this show?
That's about right.
Yeah, no, Arnold Drummond, like, him and a friend end up meeting this guy who's, like, a child molester.
Oh, you know what? I might have actually seen that show years later. I might have actually sought out that show just because I heard how messed up that particular episode was.
They kind of leave in the laugh track for a lot of it. And, yeah, that doesn't do anyone any favors.
So what you're saying is my drunk driving cop might not be that out of place in the 80s.
Pretty much, yeah. Look, that entire show was kind of rich white guy comes by and steals two black kids. Like, I mean, you watch the opening, and it's like he pulls up in a limo at, like, a playground and beckons two kids into his car. And they go with him, and then they just live with him in his mansion for the rest of their lives. Like...
So that's where the inspiration for Angelina Jolie came from, is what you're saying.
Madonna. You know, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt seem to actually legally adopt them. Madonna just tries to just pluck them, you know? Just like, I'll take one like this and one from over here, you know, just ship them out to me.
She realizes, you know, there's laws in the U.S. and laws in England, but come on. When you're in a country that she doesn't want to be in anyway and she has no respect for anything that's happening around her, is she really going to imagine that there's laws in countries that she hasn't lived in?
It's a good point.
I'm actually worried whenever she comes up to Canada. I mean, for God's sakes, who knows what she would do up here?
Well, do you actually have laws up in Canada?
Not many.
It's right, there's just like the Zamboni law.
Beavers, moose, you know, they have rights.
Right. And of course, Timbit franchises. You know, the
oh, God,
Tim Hortons,
you know,
like, yeah.
There has to be laws around that. I mean, unlike this podcast, those have high quality controls.
Mm. You know, I hear tell that there actually is a Tim Hortons for every man, woman, and child in Canada at this point.
It's sad, though. You know, I live out on the West Coast, and there's actually more Starbucks than Tim Hortons here.
That's screwy.
It is. You know, you go anywhere else in Canada, and there might be the occasional token Starbucks, you know, but out here it's the token Tim Hortons.
Weird. I mean, there's a Tim Hortons in New York.
Oh, yeah, no, they've tried to shove that as far across the border as it would go, quite unsuccessfully, I might add, but...
They're fairly popular when they pop up down here.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. I know when we had a Krispy Kreme here, it only lasted about a year before they went out of business, so...
Well, let's face it, though, Krispy Kreme donuts are bullshit.
Well, they're not donuts.
Right. They're like screwy, way too sweet cake.
Yeah. They're cake that somehow got thrown in a deep fryer.
Yeah, it just doesn't work for me.
No, that's clearly what this podcast is all about, though, you know. Tim Hortons versus Krispy Kreme.
Well, we can also talk about comics. Now, usually, you know, they will discuss some comics that are recent.
That's right. Usually the week of.
Usually the week of, but that would require us to, again, do work.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that we would only therapize comics that came out 30 years ago this month.
That's right. January 1984, the richest month in comic history.
It really kind of was. Like, and again, you're way too young, so shut the hell up. But I have fond memories of this. This was the month of the very first... And sadly, not only, but the very first Assistant Editor's Month at Marvel.
Yeah, that was what I took away from reading it. They all went more than a little out of their way to tell the reader who to blame.
Yeah, they were just like, you know, let's just have a month where we just go stupid. And in glorious, glorious ways. They did try this again in like the early 2000s sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really work too well. And I think it's just one of those, it's a joke you can only do once.
Oh, it definitely was a one-off in a lot of these things. You know, they went meta, they went a whole bunch of other things. I mean, I've seen it more recently in, like, FF by Fraction and stuff like that. But to the extent that they did it in 1984 was just masterful.
Yeah. Well, and Fraction's actually related back to the original Volume 1 of Fantastic Four, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Where they went meta like that. You know, Marvel's very good at doing the meta thing. historically. But no, Assistant Editor's Month was something special.
It was. I was glad you talked me into reading it for this project.
Yeah. So which issue did you pick? Let's get
into this. I picked Dazzler number 30 because realistically, it's been so long since there's been any Dazzler comic that I just felt that I had to.
Fair. Now, of course, this had a cover, and one of my favorite notes is people laugh at Dazzler. People, you know, don't take Dazzler seriously. Whereas I do think the book was like 20 years before its time.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But, you know, Sienkiewicz, who is one of the most amazing artists out there, you know, he did a lot of the covers for Dazzler, and it wasn't a case of, some people seem to think, like, it was Marvel's just like, oh, well, if we put him on there, it'll sell the book.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently asked them if he could do it.
Wow.
Because he was a fan.
It was a remarkably good comic. I was expecting it to be a lot worse than it was, even with Assistant Editor's Month. It was taking itself a lot more seriously than I thought a comic about Dazzler was going to.
Well, we'll tell the nice people who haven't tuned out yet because we're idiots about the comic.
Well, in Dazzler number 30, she has recently become attached to a movie star who's kind of a bit past his prime, and they're on a plane when it's shot down, and eventually she is back in the city and trying to piece her life together and saved by Marvel editor Ralph Macchiato. And it kind of goes from there and goes as they travel to a comics convention and all sorts of other things. But the fact was, in spite of all the references to comics and comic book editing, there was an underlying tale of self-reliance in this book that was actually quite impressive.
Yeah, I find the Dazzler book of the time was a lot about that. I mean, you know, the first few issues of Dazzler, and if you haven't gotten them, you can get the Essential Dazzler, like Volume 1 and 2. Fairly cheap. They're black and white. They're awesome. But the Essential Dazzler stories, like the first few issues, she runs into Galactus. She fights Doctor Doom. The first like two issues, she fights Enchantress.
No, it's funny because in more recent Marvel history, Dazzler's kind of been brought back, and she's being used by Brian Bendis for all sorts of things. But the original character in that run was taking herself more seriously and accomplishing more than the supposed reboot of the character they're putting her through now. And it's still a step down from what she was accomplishing in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it was as goofy as a lot of the concept was. And, you know, the idea that, like, Dazzler beat Doctor Doom has always been just kind of silly. And that, like, Galactus falls in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
That was a strange note. But still, the character itself, like, as a character, I think there was a lot of interesting depth there that was occasionally masked by the style of writing of the time.
Oh, well, I think that can be true for any character in the 80s, though. It's, you have to read the story and not just the dialogue or the narration.
Right.
Because
right.
A you lot of that...
Set dressing.
Well, yeah, you have to, because the set dressing was very wordy back then, had a certain style of writing, and... You know, certainly they had a way they liked to tell it, but that didn't take away from what the characters were achieving in those stories.
Right. So let's see. So Dazzler, very self-reliant?
Yeah, no, she's trying to deal with all the stuff on her own. She doesn't want to sell out for fame, and, you know, I clearly differ from her there, because I'm doing this solely for the fame right now.
Oh, yeah, you'll have hordes of followers now.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to figure out if I can achieve that sort of special status that podcast hosts do, where they have people that are kind of clinging off their every word in a way that makes kind of the outside world uncomfortable. That's my goal for today.
Nice. I approve.
Yeah. Yeah. But Dazzler's self-reliant, you know, she's trying to do this on her own. She doesn't want to sell out. She wants to stay loyal to the people who have helped her so far. And, you know, at the end of the day, she's very convinced that... even when she's out of her depth, she can find a way to beat the odds.
Yeah. I've always loved Dazzler, and I still maintain that the series, and if you haven't read more than just this issue...
I flipped through the one before and after it for what that's worth.
Yeah, I really do suggest you find, like, the first volume of The Essential, at least. And, of course, later on, she, you know, has the... What is it? What's that miniseries called? The graphic novel or something, miniseries with Beast... That was kind of groundbreaking at the time.
I'm not sure I've read that, and I'd probably have to look it up.
Yeah, it's called, like, Beauty and the Beast.
Okay. No, I read the more recent Dazzler series where she was doing the extreme X-Men stuff, but that was my most recent exposure to Dazzler. Well, I was just going to say, other than the occasional joke reference they throw about her into other comics.
Sure. But no, back in the 80s, you know, Marvel did a graphic novel series. Mm-hmm. They were all very tall, very thin, like they were, you know, the size of like a one-shot, but they were oversized in terms of the page size itself, and that's where New Mutants first appeared.
Okay.
Was the New Mutants graphic novel, before there was like an issue one for New Mutants, like that's where Claremont did that. Byrne did a She-Hulk graphic novel that was like a big status change for She-Hulk. And there was a Dazzler the Movie, is what it was called.
Okay. You know, I was reading a bit about that. Apparently Marvel had big plans for Dazzler at the time. And they really had sort of planned on doing an actual movie for the character, had gotten everything ready. And then Disco failed, and
right,
that changed everything for them.
Well, the original concept was actually there was a I forget who it was, but they were going to do this as one of their, like, this is an actual musician.
Mm-hmm.
And that deal fell apart, and they decided to move forward anyway. So yeah, Dazzler kind of comes from this merging of the real world and the Marvel Universe, which is always just a step removed anyway, especially back then. Although it does lead to one of my favorite weird Dazzler moments. The first time you ever see the character is in an issue of X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the X-Men are like, you know, oh, we found this new mutant. You know, not new mutant, but we found this new mutant from Cerebro. We're gonna go, you know, hunt it down. And they go to this club.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, the 80s, and it's Marvel. And they go to this club where Dazzler's performing. And Disco, remember?
Yes.
Except everyone in the club was drawn to look like a 70s punk from, like, the East Village, New York, like, punk scene.
Okay, then.
And it was just this weird disconnect, because, you know, I wasn't very, like, I was, like, you know, 10 or 11 at that point when I first read all that stuff. But growing up in New York, you know, I still had a grasp of, kind of, not a good grasp of the music scene, but, you know, you have a grasp of what people look like and where some of the stuff goes. And it was just this weird disconnect even then for me, of just like, why is there not a riot?
Well, it's because clearly Dazzler was not only a cross-media artist, but she was a crossover artist and the first person to be succeeding in the punk disco movement.
Yes, I firmly believe this.
That's the only explanation I'm willing to consider. It's just
it
crossover appeal to the punk scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's either that or lazy, you know, editors, but, you know, that never happens, so...
You know, I think it was one of those, like, well, artists drew these people, whatever, who cares? No one,
yeah, no
really, it doesn't really matter, you know, just keep moving.
And yet, 30 years later, that's something you're remembering.
Right.
So,
well, that's
clearly
how it happens,
it had an
I
impact.
Think. It's always those side things, and that's something I've been learning and relearning as I write more comics, is just that little side-off, one-off thing that you're like, eh, whatever, it's fine, that's the thing people hinge on. That's the one that'll get you in trouble.
And that's the one people are going to be pointing to his work 30 years later going, Adam, why did you do this way back then?
Yeah.
And luckily in your case, you won't remember it, so it'll all
exactly.
be okay.
I'll just be like, I did? and they'll be like, you doddering old fool. Give me
that's
some
right.
applesauce.
And that'll
Where's
be 2 years from now.
Yeah, pretty much. So. I firmly believe that. No, I've always been kind of, not obsessed with Dazzler, but love the idea of music and comics, because I think they are very related. I mean, think about the number of comic artists and writers you know who are also musicians.
No, it's true that there's some real crossover people there, you know, doing a lot of different creative endeavors. And, you know, Marvel's trying to get into that right now with their whole Gamma digital comics thing where they're planning to add background music to comics.
Right.
I don't really think that'll work, but, you know, it's a neat idea.
Well, I hope, like, at least, like, when they have Allred do a comic and they want to have Beth, they have his band do it.
That would be really, really cool. I'd actually enjoy that a lot more than if they just hired generic background composers.
Right, but that's the thing. There are enough people in comics who do play music. You could actually do that. And I think that would be something the fans would love.
Well, at least the internet fans. It's really hard to say what the store fans that, you know, show up and only buy their monthly issues. But
those people aren't going to be looking at it online anyway, are they?
Probably not. As much as Marvel's trying to push for that, I think there's still that very two different worlds going on there. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I look with Amelia Cole, because I can't help but get the plug in for books I write. You know, Nick Brokenshire, our artist, is also a very accomplished guitarist. Like, he has a band.
Well, I did not know that. I've got a piece of his original art, but I didn't know he had a band.
Yeah, no, I knew he was a guitarist. I didn't realize, like, how serious it was, because it never came up until we all went to Baltimore. Like, he came in from England. And he's like, oh, yeah, we were driving up there, and we're listening to music. And he's like, oh, well, here, you should put in, like, my band CD. And we're like, well, okay. And he's really good.
So now you're saying that you're going to be pushing the digital frontier forward and putting his band into Amelia Cole.
Well, he was actually talking about, on his own, and we were very supportive of it, of writing an album of songs that all tie into Amelia Cole.
Wow, that would be pretty cool.
Wouldn't it? Just like the artist just being like, also, here you go. I'm like, please do that. That's like the most awesome thing ever.
Yeah, so instead of just saying art by Nick, it'll say art and music by Nick and have a link to the album.
Would that not be the weirdest and most awesome, like, comic credit ever?
Oh, yeah, because I don't think we've seen that yet. You know, we've seen people that have, you know, claimed art and writing, but art and music, you could actually have a first right there.
Yeah, I do think, we've talked about, after a certain, there's a certain issue after which we want to do an oversized hardcover, like an omnibus.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are cool, and who doesn't want to do one of those in their life? But one of the things I kept saying about it was that I want to include a CD. Like, that's where we put Nick's music.
That's the time. You just include it on the cover of the omnibus, and it's the perfect extra for people like myself that have, you know, already paid for all your digital comics.
Right. You know, it's like there's the CD, and we'll have, like, a code to also download it, because who has CDs now?
Yeah, my laptop doesn't even have a CD drive at this point.
Right. Like, maybe we'll put, like, a USB stick. Because that's a thing. But yeah, just, you know, include an album with it of music by the artist about the book. Genius. But this is what Dazzler was seeing happening way back in the 80s. That's the thing.
No, and it's amazing how sometimes these ideas, like you said, when they're 20 years before their time, no one even goes back and points to them now. I mean, when you're hearing all this talk about, you know, crossover with digital media and, you know, the movies coming to life from comics, no one says, hey, that's what they were trying to do with Dazzler back in the 80s.
Right. I mean, well, Dazzler kind of became this joke because of the disco connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real shame because, like I said, the book itself, if you look at the book, was one of the first books to deal with... I mean, Dazzler originally didn't want to be a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she fought crime because it, like, happened in front of her or because she's in the Marvel Universe. You know, in the first two issues, it's like Enchantress, for some reason that never makes sense, decides she wants this gig.
Music gig?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so she's, like, auditioning against Dazzler. And Dazzler gets the slot, so the judge decides she's going to kill Dazzler.
Well, yeah, that's how you handle things in the Marvel Universe, you know. First, you go out there and compete like a normal person, you know. You don't trade off on the fact that you're a god, you know, that people would be interested in you anyway. And then once the normal person routine disappears, you go straight to violence.
Right. I mean, that, you know, makes sense to me. That's how I live my life.
Oh, yeah, no, it's the day-to-day thing. You know, if you go, you pick up your mail, and if you didn't get the piece of mail you want, you track down your postal delivery person, and you attack them violently until they hand it to you.
Yeah, actually, if you give me a second, I think I can find, because what people don't know probably is that I actually did a short-lived column, if there are reasons for that, but actually writing about every single issue of Dazzler.
Wow. And I'd like to point out to anyone listening right now, I did not know this when I chose that issue.
Yeah, no, it was called the Dazzler Service Announcement.
Wow.
And the only issues I ever, like two of them at least, are in a book of essays I have, what I was telling you before we started recording. But in one of these, here we go. I have some dialogue.
Okay.
That I just copied from the issue. And this is from the first issue of Dazzler, you know, her and the Enchantress are auditioning for the same gig. And the Enchantress, you know, speak thy choice, mortal! And, of course, because it was the 80s, so, you know, the club owner's going, Enchanty? Because, dear lord, why would you ever say that?
Yeah.
You're the finest specimen of womanhood I've ever laid eyes upon. You can have my car, my house, me even, but Dazzler, your voice makes it all happen. You get the gig! To which Dazzler replies, far out!
Wow. Yeah, that goes back to you saying the writing at the time was something special.
Right, and then she, you know, Enchantress gets pissed, and so she blows up part of the auditorium. And the club owner just goes, gosh, look at what she's done to my wall just by pointing at it. And I've always just felt like at the point where the Enchantress blows up part of your building, you're not like, gosh, you're going, what's the Avengers phone number?
Well, you know, and that's the funny thing about the Marvel Universe back in the 80s. They had all these characters that were, you know, running rampant in New York and across the globe. Yet people treated them like, oh, well, I've never seen this before. Right. It's not like now where Marvel, you know, very much acknowledges that regular people would kind of be like, oh, yeah, they're superheroes. I understand this world to some extent. At that point in time, it was like every time anything happened around a normal person, it was horribly shocking and surprising.
Well, I mean, and I think a lot of that actually makes sense to me the way it's grown because, you know, Marvel was always supposed to be our world one step removed.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you have something new like that, there's always this weird break-in period that can last years. Mm-hmm. Where you just don't believe it's happening. You know, like, is this, really? This? And, you know, you hear it from a friend, but you don't believe it. And after a while, everyone just switches from, really? To just being completely jaded. And I feel like the Marvel Universe has kind of grown that way organically.
No, and that's a good point. I mean, that's one of the things that growing up I always loved about the Marvel Universe is how it tried to be that one step removed and how it tried to sort of relate to things at the time. Right. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I liked Marvel and have never really connected with DC.
Right. See, whereas I like DC, well, in the old days, I liked it, you know, pre-New 52, because New 52 kind of broke the thing I love the most about DC, frankly,
mm-hmm.
which was the sense of legacy.
Right.
You know, because at Marvel, Spider-Man is Peter Parker.
Right.
But at DC, you know, the Flash can be a title that's passed down. And that aspect of legacy and how, you know, history grows and falls into itself is something I've always connected with and loved. And so I always loved DC for that, you know, for that legacy aspect. For like, there's, oh, the Justice Society, and they're helping train a next generation. Then there's the Justice League, you know, and you get them together and they don't fight so much as it's just like the Justice Society's like, well, in my day, you know, we did it like this.
Yeah, the closest I can come to that with growing up was with the legacy of the Power Rangers and how, you know, each team would acknowledge the previous team sure. and somehow Tommy ended up on all the shows.
Well, like you do.
Yeah.
There's always that one guy.
Yeah. But, can't move on.
Yeah, I mean, well, see, for me, and this is a thing, it's like, you know, my father was a writer. My mother is a writer and an editor. And so growing up, I always wanted to write. So there's always that sense of legacy in my head. Of like, mm-hmm. you know, you do what your parents did, and you try to do it better, and you learn from them, and you kind of resent them for it in a weird way.
See, in my family, it's a very different legacy. My grandfather was an engineer. Mm-hmm. My father then started in engineering and became a math major, and I started in math and ended up in economics. So we're pretty sure that when I have kids, you know, they're going to end up in the fine arts.
Right. There's a drift.
Yeah. It happens every generation in my family.
See, I like that, though.
Yeah.
But again, it's that legacy, and that's what I loved about DC, but Marvel was very much, you know, those guys next door.
Yeah.
And of course, growing up in New York with the Marvel Universe was really kind of interesting because, you know, like, where Doctor Strange's townhouse was
mm-hmm.
is actually an address that doesn't exist. It's kind of between two buildings.
Well, that's a very neat little thing for fans, I suppose, if they live around there.
Right, and that thing is like, you know, where it used to be, there was a cafe that, like, I used to go to sometimes, like, my father, you know, go get, like, lunch downtown. And wow. It's like, you know, there, that's where Doctor Strange's building would be. You know, Avengers Mansion, like, all these buildings, they had addresses.
No, that's,
So you can go and just be like, the Marvel Universe is, like, right here, you know?
It's in between these two buildings.
Right, which makes sense for Doctor Strange.
It does. And, I mean, that's a very different thing with Marvel. I mean, one of the things I loved growing up was that, the whole archetype of Spider-Man was always going to be the same character that I was reading in the books. You know, if I picked up a current issue, it still matched with the archetype, that kind of unchanging character focus. The events of Peter Parker's life might change, but the whole idea of who is Spider-Man and what does he represent has remained completely consistent right up until Superior Spider-Man.
Right. And in a way, it still is consistent even there, because, you know, he'll eventually come back and that'll be all folded in.
It's true, and he'll go back to that same sort of major one focus, great power, responsibility, all that type of stuff, and by then we'll be on the third or fourth reboot of the movie series.
Sure. You know, whatever. But yeah, but like, you know, for me, like, the Wade's Flash in the 90s
mm-hmm.
is the epitome of legacy. You know, I mean, he starts off with, like, Wally kind of being like, I can't live up to this. and gets past that in his first arc. And then he folds in slowly over time, like every speedster in the DC Universe, and makes a cohesive legacy concept out of it. To where here's, you know, here's Wally West. He's the Flash now. He's not the first. He's not the second. You know?
Yeah, no, and it's funny. Like, when they try to do that in the Marvel Universe, quite often it fails completely. Like, the JMS other run of Spider-Man. I don't know if you've read that one. Where they try to make a coherent spider mythology out of all the spider characters in the Marvel Universe and connect them through a bit of a mystical force.
Okay.
And instead of succeeding the way Wade did with The Flash, it's largely considered one of the worst arcs in Spider-Man history.
Well, right, because it doesn't, because I think Marvel, like I said, Marvel characters are way too tied down for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only character it's ever really worked with is Captain America. Mm-hmm. Because there have been a number of them. And even in like the 70s, they were already playing with, well, if he was frozen, and but there were still Captain America stories in the 50s, that means there had to be a different guy.
But you look now, and when you had the most recent death of Captain America,
mm-hmm.
I think it's moved into that point where it's unchanging now, because it was just a given when that happened, to the fans at least, that he was going to come back as Steve Rogers.
But even then, remember, it was retroactively. It was because in the time when they were doing the stories in the 50s, it was supposed to be, you know, Captain America.
Yeah.
And it was only when they brought him back, you know, in the Marvel Universe proper, that they decided that retroactively those had to be other people. So at the time, people reading it didn't have that, and retroactively there was always that, well, and then Steve comes back. And that's fine. You know, it's... I have no problem with the, and then he comes back. I just think that when you do the picking up the mantle to use it, in Captain America's case, as a reflection, and I think like they're doing with Superior Spider-Man, for why it has to be him.
You know, though, that does move us to our second title and the sense of legacy, because one of the few places you do see that is with Galactus's Herald.
It's true. I chose Marvel Team-Up 137, which is Aunt May and Franklin Richards versus Galactus.
And you'll let us know what happened in that one?
I will. One of the interesting conceits of the issue, of course, is that the Fantastic Four, who are friends of Spider-Man, need someone to look after Franklin Richards for a little bit. And so Peter asks Aunt May.
Well, and that's just the obvious thing at the time, because, you know, she clearly hates Spider-Man, but as soon as he says, babysit this young child, she's all over it.
Well, right, and he didn't even have to come in and say it from Spider-Man point, you know, just Peter Parker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know these guys, and they're looking for someone, and, you know, hey, let me drop a small child on you, make him some wheat cakes, and shut the hell up.
That's right.
But, of course, Galactus comes calling.
Mm-hmm.
And because Franklin Richards is a being of immense power, and Galactus wanted to make him his herald, which this issue gets even funnier off of Hickman's Fantastic Four run.
It's true. Like, this issue has just held up remarkably well considering the subject matter.
Right. I mean, well, you know, that's the thing. It's like Galactus wanted to make Franklin his herald. And if you read Hickman's Fantastic Four run, my favorite thing in that run, actually, is the adult Franklin Richards, his herald is Galactus. And it was that one page where it's like, you know, to me, my herald, and it's Galactus, is so amazing.
You know, and not to get to the end of the issue yet, but yeah. Given Franklin's powers and his ability to alter reality, as you get to the end of this issue and they kind of go all Inception about a dream within a dream within a dream, it really would be open to Marvel now, given Franklin's powers, to put this issue back into continuity someday.
I think that they should. But so what ends up happening, of course, is that Aunt May doesn't want to put this child in danger of being the Herald of Galactus. And it is a weird case of, you know, although she's like, what's a Galactus? She still understands that don't give the child to the space giant. Which...
That's good advice under any circumstances.
It really is. It's babysitting 101, guys. It's don't give your child to a space giant. It's simple. So instead she offers up herself because, you know, she's Aunt May.
That's right, and she's easily able to circumvent Galactus's powers and his intent and, you know, just somehow take that over.
Right, and so she becomes, Aunt May becomes, for an issue, the Herald of Galactus. And, of course, all Heralds of Galactus get new names, you know, like Norrin Rad wasn't the Silver Surfer before that. You know, Frankie Ray, was it? Wasn't
yep.
Nova. You know, all of this. So, of course, Aunt May becomes Golden Oldie. And flies around by what seems to be cosmic power coming out of her hair bun.
Well, I mean, that's her source of strength in the Marvel Universe, you know.
And I also wonder if they chose the Golden Oldie thing, not only for the name, but for the subtle Golden Girls joke.
Okay, I was seeing it as a natural progression from Silver Surfer to Golden Oli myself, but...
Well, sure.
It could be both.
It could be both. And so, you know, Aunt May is the Herald of Galactus for a little bit, and it's like, don't eat planets, that's rude. And makes him, like, giant space wheat cakes.
Oh, no, you're leaving out a step here. She doesn't make him eat the space wheat cakes. Franklin offers him the Twinkle, the Marvel version of the Twinkie, since they had just got out of that contract. And Galactus found that Twinkies were a good source of sustenance.
Yeah, Marvel screwing up a generation of kids eating.
That's right. So if anyone out there has diabetes now and grew up reading this, there's a lawsuit right there for you.
Yeah, go ahead. Go for it. We'll just sit here and wait. So yeah, Golden Oldie. I love it. Again, from a character standpoint, like the Dazzler one, it actually really does work in that, you know, Aunt May being, you know, between her and Uncle Ben, who taught Peter that, you know, great power, great responsibility, steps in the way of this great power because she doesn't think that a child can handle the responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and just wants to protect this kid, and then goes off and is kind of spiritually like, this is what Peter Parker wishes how he would behave if he ever ended up in this situation.
Yeah, no, and it shows again that heritage that Peter Parker comes from and where he gets this from, and, you know, kind of establishes the fact that it's not just from Uncle Ben that he has this great power, great responsibility mantra.
Right. Weirdly, I just had this sudden thought of, wait a minute, Marvel has never collected the original Assistant Editor of Month books, and I think there's an omnibus in there.
No, that's a perfect opportunity for one, especially when they go back and bring Aunt May as Galactus's herald into continuity permanently.
Right. You know, next time, instead of dying, we find out that that's what she's doing.
That she still has a little bit of the power cosmic in her that Franklin didn't absorb and shift reality around.
There was, back when the Heroes Reborn Onslaught stuff happened,
mm-hmm.
I actually had a friend who dead seriously was thinking that the Golden Oli, that was going to be the solution. Was it like Franklin Richards left a little bit of power cosmic in Aunt May and that she was going to bring everyone back?
I don't think they were ready for that at that point in time.
I don't think they were, but it was beautiful. Like, it was just... Because you could see it happening.
Oh, and you can see it happening now. Like, it's...
No more mutants. I don't think that's very nice. That's kind of rude. You know, just undoes it. Like, there's going to be a plot at some point where that happens.
No, the funny thing for this one was I was kind of curious about what the letters page would reflect later on about this issue a few issues later. Mm. And Stan Lee actually wrote in about this issue and said that, you know, this really just showed how attractive Aunt May is, and you could really understand why Dr. Octopus would want to marry her.
Well, that's creepy.
Yeah. So, I mean, while we're bringing stuff back, like reminding people about Dr. Octopus's attempted marriage to Aunt May, it's the perfect time to bring back Aunt May, Herald of Galactus.
Wow. Wow. I just don't even...
And you realize by having this conversation, they'll never let you write a Marvel comic now.
I'm pretty sure. But, you know, I'm also the person who once suggested the next Marvel crossover should be a 17-issue miniseries called Dance Wars, which was essentially a rewrite of Civil War, except it was Captain America and Iron Man having a dance-off.
Oh, man, that would be classic.
You know, because Tony's all like, I'm going to do the robot, you know, and Captain America's doing the hustle, you know.
Well, hey, you know, this is Tony we're talking about. I am sure he has built a suit of armor specifically for dance.
Good Lord. Kieran Gillen, if you're listening and you're still writing Iron Man and you need an idea, you just use it right now. Just go for it.
It's free to the world now. It's yours. Just take it.
That's fucking genius. That's what that is. The dance armor. I love it.
Well, can't you just imagine, you know, he shows up to a party in a slick suit, but it's too tight for him to dance in, and everyone's kind of doubting that he's going to have a really good time there, expecting him just to go off in the corner and talk to Pepper. And instead, out of nowhere, the dance armor rockets onto the floor, takes over his body, and it goes from there.
Nice. Now, okay, actually, in the usual comics therapy, they take breaks between segments where they put in, you know, people call in and leave confessions. We have not put in a break, so I don't know if this has been edited. We're not editing this. Are you crazy? We're not doing any actual work.
Thanks, Andrea.
Woo! So I don't know if she's found a break yet, but just in case, let's put some stuff here.
Okay, hopefully that happens. Pause.
Well, yeah, she can make a pause. That's easy.
And then right after this pause, she could put in another break.
See how easy we're making it for you. We're horrible, horrible people. Loving you isn't the right thing to do. How can I ever change things that I feel? If I could. The other thing that happens in comics therapy, which I think should also happen in comics therapy, is they do grief counseling, which seems to be just make Andrea cry.
There's theoretically depth there. You know, they go into the issues, but let's be honest, as a listener, you're hearing it to hear her cry.
Yes. But Andrea's not here, and neither one of us is going to break down tears over comics. Not saying there's anything wrong with that, but we're heartless, soulless bastards, so it's not going to happen.
I reserve all my crying for Disney movies.
Iron Giant, yo.
That's actually on the plan this weekend. We're nice. Watching it. It's a rental for 99 cents this weekend.
Sweet.
And by the time you listen to this, weekend. That will... Pardon?
I've been having an 80s weekend.
Okay, so what's that been?
Indiana Jones, some Die Hard, you know.
Which one did you end up going with? Last Crusade?
Oh, Raiders.
Or... All right.
Start at the start.
Yeah, that's what you got to do.
But anyway, so since we weren't going to do grief counseling, and it is usually just focused on making Andrea miserable, it seems, we thought we'd flip this up, and instead of grief counseling, we would do, go ahead and say it.
Grief romseling.
Yes. This is our attempt to make Aaron cry when he listens to this.
That's right. It's not anyone crying now, but as you're listening, try to And, you know, just imagine Aaron crying tears of absolute horror.
Yeah, just the salty, delicious tears of hate. So what are we doing here with the grief romsling? Well, we can talk about ROM.
I can say that I actually read my first issues of ROM for this specific segment. I hadn't read any before.
Well, what do you think?
You know, reading the first issue, he still kind of seems to be a robot.
Well, it's true.
You know, they talk about how it's a cyborg, and, you know, Aaron's very particular about Rom is not a robot. But to me, as I'm reading this and they take away all of Rom's humanity, he kind of just seemed like a robot at that point.
Yeah, he's kind of a meaty robot, I think, is the technical term for that. Rom, of course, is, at a certain level, nothing but a toy tie-in.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that's bad comics. And that's the thing, is that ROM, like Micronauts, which was just a toy tie-in, were both books that I think really did go above and beyond what they were going to be on paper.
Well, I mean, the toy didn't give them a lot to work with. I mean, the toy had three functions. It kind of lit up, made a few noises, and that was pretty much it.
Right.
So you kind of have to build from there if you're going to do a comic.
Yeah, it's like when you're a superhero and your power is that, like, your eyes light up and you make noise, you're not going to get very far.
That's right. And as I'm reading through the comic and Rom is using his light-up powers to save the day, it's kind of clear that they put a lot more thought into it than the toy maker did.
Well, they had no choice.
That's right. When you start with light-ups, you kind of got to build. So right. It was neat, though. I enjoyed reading it, and I read both the first issue as well as the January 1984 50th issue spectacular to, you know, keep with our 1984 theme. So,
yeah. No, you know, and Bill Mantlo pretty much just did the entire book. The run is very fondly remembered for a lot of good reasons.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, like it tends to have its own mythology going on there, but it does cross over with the Marvel Universe.
Right.
Like the issue I read was actually talking about the Skrulls and the Dire Wraiths and was actually establishing a link between them, which, you know, really does tie them together.
Yeah.
And that's the type of thing that you only get when someone has enough freedom to sort of build their own universe within your universe.
Right, which of course bit them later because, and this is like Micronauts, they invented so many new characters that they have the rights to, but they don't have the rights anymore to ROM.
That's right.
You know, and again, this is like the Micronauts. Like, there's Bug, who's now, like, in Guardians of the Galaxy. I don't know if he's in the current comic, but he was in the Abnett Landing stuff. And he was a character in Micronauts that Marvel invented, so they can still use him. The actual Microverse that they put Micronauts in that Marvel can still use, they just can't use the Micronauts. They can't use all the original characters that were in the toys. So, you know, Marvel can use Space Knights.
Yeah.
And they do.
In Infinity.
But they can't use ROM himself.
No, and I know this will hurt Aaron to hear this, but I actually wonder at this point if there's all that much value in licensing ROM. Because for all the effort they put into building ROM as a character, to almost any new reader, he will be just another Space Knight robot.
Yeah, I think if you reprint it, if you read the entire run, I will give this, that the actual run was a really good Marvel comic for the time. It had, you know, the big space adventure stuff. It had kind of the mythology on the level of the Thor comics at the time. There was a lot going on there that was really good. And, you know, and some of it was like, you know, ROM would use this little analyzer to find Dire Wraiths because they're shapeshifters who had been invading Earth, and use his little neutralizer to send them to another dimension, but it looked like he was just killing humans.
That's right.
So there's a lot of meat there, and Mantlo really, you know, brought it home. I think if they could ever get the rights to reprint ROM, if anyone could ever get the rights to reprint ROM, I think there's a lot to like there. I think even modern comic readers would enjoy it.
Oh, and I fully agree with you there. I think ROM actually held up a lot better than I thought it would, and I did enjoy reading it. But my question is, beyond the reprint rights, would there ever be any value in reestablishing ROM in the Marvel Universe?
I think if you could change up the design a little bit, modernize the design, because really, it just not the best design ever.
Ooh.
In a modern sensibility. It just isn't. I mean, his gun looks like a bit of flat cardboard with a red light on the front.
Which was the capabilities of toy manufacturers at the time.
Right. But I think as a character and as a concept, if you brought back ROM with that sort of, is he a hero, is he a villain, you know, the classic Marvel misunderstood type of monster character in the form of technology, you know, it's kind of a Terminator aspect at that point. And I think that you could completely revitalize and redo ROM in a way that would be very attractive to modern readers. But the issue there is, at that point, you have to change so much of it because there is no toy base anymore and all this. It becomes a different character in a lot of ways.
Well, at that point, why not just have a different Space Knight that isn't ROM? I mean, ROM isn't going to resonate as a name with younger readers anyway. I mean, read-only memory is not something most people talk about it anymore.
Right. It's true.
I mean, at this point, you'd have better odds with USB the Space Knight.
And a sidekick, HDMI. Yeah, I think the problem with using the Space Knight name to relaunch, and they tried that, they did a Space Knight miniseries, is that new readers are kind of like, Space Knight is such a generic term, and old readers just want ROM, so they reject it. I think if you go completely new, and the problem is there, of course, that you end up with people going, oh, you're ripping off ROM. And this is the problem with, you know, any of these, going all the way back, this is the problem with Dazzler, is that you want to bring back the concept of Dazzler, but you can't because of all the baggage, and yet, if you try to redo the character from the ground up, all of the existing fans are like, you're just stealing this. And it's a problem. I mean, that is an issue that I think is a legitimate problem for them doing it.
Well, and that goes back to DC, where they actually have legacy heroes where, you know, you can actually pass the mantle.
Right.
You know, if you had Dazzler passing the mantle to a new similar character, it would work a lot better than sort of saying, this is like Dazzler, only different.
Yeah.
But Marvel doesn't do that. With Marvel, they get one shot at every concept, and if it doesn't work out, they bury it forever.
Well, because again, because they don't really have a legacy base, and their readership isn't trained to think that way.
I like the fact that I'm not trained to read DC. That's a really interesting concept.
I think both universes, and even like the Image universe in the 90s, there is a certain thing of there are ground rules to how a universe works.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not steeped in them, if you don't have any experience in them, and they don't resonate, you know, there's a certain learning how to read in a way is an important thing. I'm a very firm believer of, like, certain books, the author, you have to learn how to read that book.
Right.
You know, Infinite Jest, I was just talking about with a friend, which is a book I absolutely adore. You have to learn how to read that book. It doesn't read like a normal book in a lot of ways.
And having not read that book, I actually can't speak to that.
Well, fair enough. But there are books like that, and that's perfectly viable. You know, reading Simonson's Thor, it reads differently than anything else.
Which can be a very good thing, as long as you're prepared to read it that way.
Right, and as long as you're prepared to trust in the craft and let it show you what it's doing, and you learn the language of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the universes work the same way.
Well, I mean, I've actually said before that if DC ever puts out a digital unlimited service where I can just deep dive into it and read a couple hundred issues to actually get a feel for it, I'd be prepared to pick up some of the modern monthlies. But right now, like, I pick up any of these DC books and I'm overwhelmed by a different style of writing that doesn't make sense to me. And I don't really know how to place it, and I don't really know what to do with it a lot of the time. And then anytime I say that to someone, they're like, oh, well, that's because you haven't read this. And then when I read that, they say, oh, well, you have to go back even further for this piece to really understand why they did it that way. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger what I'm expected to know and understand, read one issue.
Yeah, I think that we hit a weird cultural shift where when I was a kid, at least, you know, I came into, you know, Marvel and DC. Well, my father read comics, so I started reading, like, his old Lee and Kirby, like, you know, X-Men issues. But, you know, I started reading DC kind of cold. I knew who Superman was. I knew who Batman was. There were Super Friends cartoons. Of course I knew mm-hmm. those characters. And they're kind of too big to not know who they are. But I started right before Crisis. So I came in, like, a year or so max, like, right before everything changed. And
right.
I had no clue. When I was reading Crisis, I'm like, I don't know who any of these characters are. But it was exciting when you're a kid. And there is that certain level of, like, you want to be in, you want to learn the secret handshake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we get older, we don't want to put in the work because there are so many more options.
Well, and it's hard, too. Like, I have in my head certain archetypes about how certain characters in DC are, you know, who they're supposed to be with, what they're supposed to be. And New 52 is telling all new stories, but it also completely clashes with everything I've built up in my head about these characters. You know, there's not that same Superman Lois Lane relationship.
Right.
You know, Batman has a very different multifaceted relationship with multiple Robins that all kind of worked with him for a year. And so it's kind of what you were saying before, you know, if you start fresh with the same characters, you're going to clash with people's expectations too.
Yeah, no, it's an issue. I mean, you know, again, like I can, and like everyone else, you know, I can sit there and be like, well, if you want to see, like, what made me love Flash, for instance, you know, you start with, there's a very certain Wade arc.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a bunch of, like, the Wade trades that you can get, or I suppose they're, I don't know if they're out digitally, that can show you this. You know, there's the Giffen Timotees Justice League stuff. I don't think you really need anything in there. They give you all the character that you need. You know, there are certain writers in certain moments where that happens. But the downside to the legacy stuff is that when you do come in late, you do have to do some legwork because you don't get why the legacy matters. You know, there are books in the 90s like Starman.
Okay.
Which is all built on legacy, but it was a new character.
See, and that's something that would very much confuse me going in fresh to DC. Like, you talk about specific runs, and so I've asked for different runs or miniseries, and people have recommended them, and I've tried them, and so I read, like, Mark Waid's Birthright for Superman, and that just reestablished how I view Superman and was absolutely wonderful. But then I read All-Star Superman, which Mark Waid himself recommends, and suddenly it was so many callbacks to earlier jokes or to earlier arcs, and I couldn't really follow it in spite of the fact that it was highly recommended by the guy who defined Superman for me.
Yeah, well, All-Star, I think, is the best Superman story in existence. My three Superman stories, for the record, are Birthright, which is astounding. Mm-hmm. What is now a graphic novel by Busiek and I Am Forgetting, which is a shame. Let me see if I can... I think it's... Is it Immerman? I forget. Let me take a quick look here. Which actually does not take place in any continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And is not Clark Kent, even. Yeah, it's Immerman.
Okay.
But it gets... It's called Secret Identity. It's a standalone thing. It was like a four-issue series. But it gets to the core of who Superman is as a character... Without it basically takes place in the real world, and there's this kid whose last name is Kent, whose parents named him Clark because they thought it was funny because of Superman comics,
right?
And somewhere along the line, he figures out like he actually has the powers, and so it's Superman in our world that doesn't have superheroes, and trying to figure out what that means and how to live his life and all this, but it gets to the core of the concept of Superman,
right?
Without any baggage,
yeah, and that's. Really, really great in terms of those stories, and I absolutely love that DC does a lot more of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's the way I'm able to enjoy DC, but it still makes it hard when I'm then picking up the latest monthly one and don't write it that same way.
Of course. No, also Superman for me is possibly the greatest Superman story ever told, and I don't see it in terms of the callbacks. I just see it in terms of defining Superman and his world and who he is as a character and how he relates to these other characters, and even without the history, all of that is still on the page for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see where it can also turn you off if you feel like there's a joke you're not getting.
And it really did feel that way a lot of the time.
No, I completely understand that. I see it as its own thing. I understand why some people don't.
And I've heard it described as the ultimate love letter to Superman because it integrates so much from his history and does so in a very streamlined and immediately accessible fashion. But for me, not having known the history first, I'm constantly aware when I'm reading it that there's stuff written for people that aren't me.
No, I can understand that. I think that, you know, if you can turn that voice on your head off.
I don't know. Yeah.
I think that it really can hit, but it is the, and again, it's learning how to read it. It's when you go in with that voice on, it totally feels overwhelming. I am right there with you if you don't have that backstory. But I really also do say that the backstory is not necessary for it. And if you can read it without that feeling, which I don't know if you can, you know, some people can, some people can't. There's no shame or problem with that. It becomes this great story in spite of all of that and without all of it. You know, Wade's the arc that starts Wade's greatness on his run is actually called The Return of Barry Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, you're like, well, I have to know all this. And all you need to know is Barry Allen was the Flash. Wally West was his nephew, and Barry died. And Wally is now the Flash. That's all the emotional, that's all the history you need.
And that's definitely a run that I'll try and seek out at some point in time. DC is a bit behind on all their digital stuff for their...
Well, and because they don't want to collect a lot of the older stuff because they're trying to push the new stuff, and I get that.
It's just so different because with Marvel, they've got their unlimited service. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's a couple friends of mine on Twitter who are constantly asking, okay, I enjoyed this. What can I go now read to get more of it? And they can be reading it within about 2 minutes after you make a recommendation. And with DC, a lot of it's not collected digitally. A lot of the trades are out of print. So when someone makes that recommendation, you're like, okay, well, I'm going to have to try and see if my library can order it from another library somewhere in Massachusetts.
Right. Well, Comixology has Superman Secret Identity.
All right.
Flash, I don't know if they go back that far.
You think they might with Mark Waid.
Well, I would like to think that they do. I just don't. I mean, they go way back. I don't know how forward they go. That's the problem.
Right.
Actually, no, I think they do. They have... Yeah, like, Wade's run...
Let's see what we got.
Trying to see here.
Yeah, we're both searching on Comixology rather than paying any attention to anyone who might be listening
like,
right now.
Look at this.
Oh, here we go. No, here, Flash.
It's somewhere in, like, the 73 or so, I think. Is the Return 87? Of Barry Allen?
I've got a Flash number 0, 87 to 2009. Is that a different one?
No, that's... Well, yeah, the zero
issue
was part of that. Oh,
sorry, that's not Wade's run. Yeah, yeah.
No, the zero issue was part of that. But, like, in that run, the 87 to 2009, the Return of Barry Allen stuff is right there around like 67 or so. 72, somewhere in there.
Okay.
All right. And you start there and you just keep going.
All right. I will have to check that out. And hopefully our searching Comixology during the middle of the podcast was not too distracting to any of the listeners.
You know, maybe it gets edited out. I don't know.
Or they can put a link to it in the webpage and somehow get commission, right? That's how these things work.
There you go.
Yeah, all right.
But yeah, we're hitting, I think, our time mark, and I'm sure that they'll add some music.
Or we will. We can pick our own music, and I'm sure Air refuse it anyway. So
right, you know. But yeah, no, this has been Comics Therapy with Adam P. Nave and Cameron Williams. Next week, I'm assuming you're going to be returned to your normal Comics Therapy, and it will be a much better show.
And you will never hear from us again.
Pretty much. They're gonna get this file, take us out back, and shoot us like the dogs we are.
Well deserved.
Well deserved. But
all right, thank you, Adam.
Yeah, thanks, Cam. We'll do this again some other time.
Turns into wall, and then the wall becomes